Hi, welcome to Inside Learning, episode 15 for the 17th of January 2011. Tonight, Steve Rogers and Matthew Boyle are joined by special guest Sarah Burgess from the UFA to look at mindsets and effective praise.
Good evening, Matthew.
Hi, Steve. Great to hear you. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I'm delighted to welcome back an old friend of the podcast. So it's good evening to Sarah.
I'm so happy to have you on board again, Sarah. Missed you. It's been fantastic.
Good evening, Matthew. Good evening, Steve. Nice to hear you both.
Oh, brilliant. Good. And listeners won't be getting this, but I'm thrilled about your picture, Sarah, on Skype. Lots of people put these apologetic little pictures. And Steve, I'm not pointing any fingers here, but you need a magnifying glass to find your face in the picture. Although it's a fine mountaineering picture. But Sarah, that's a great portrait. I just love it. You look great in that.
Thank you.
Well, I just realised how few actually face portraits I have of myself. I don't know whether that's deliberate or not.
I think the answer is yes. I'm sure Sarah could give you a second opinion if you need it.
I'll bring my camera into the office next time you're in, Steve.
Yeah. And thank you.
Make sure we've got a nice little close-up.
Yeah, the next time I get together with you, I'm going to take at least 10 pictures of you as well, Steve. The world needs more of it. More.
Is that right? And anyway, without the dulcet scouse tones of Jay tonight.
Yeah, you beat me to it there. Poor Jay has had a day apparently of working with his youngsters on computers, and apparently the whole thing is exhausting him. He's got a bit of a headache, so hopefully it won't be one of these dreadful bugs that are doing the rounds just now. Lots of people I know have had sickness bugs and various things, so here's hoping it's just a headache. But get yourself better and join us next week, Jay. We'll be thinking about you.
Yes, best wishes to you, Jay, and for a speedy recovery. So we've got a news episode tonight, Matthew, and Sarah's going to join us.
Is this a news episode?
No, well, a news to start with, but Sarah's a guest. But you know, Sarah always joins in the news.
I'm sure you meant this is a themed episode.
A themed episode.
With our special guest. I'm just wasting time. You realise there's an internal... listeners will be aware there's an internal competition to see who can bring us home for half an hour. I almost made it last week.
I'm going to exert some editorial control here.
Okay, go for it.
So you can start us off for tonight's broadcast then.
Okay, I thought the news this week was very full indeed. There was a stack of minor research stories that came out, so I found it a tough choice, but essentially the choice wasn't hard for me in the end. It's a Scottish story. The guy who retired from HMI in Scotland just recently, Graham Donaldson, as people who retire at senior level often do, was set to work on reviewing teacher education. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have been quite wide in its scope. It's looked at professional development reasonably widely, but largely around preschool education, you know, teacher training as such, and our first year, the NQT year in Scotland, which is called probation, and which has a guaranteed job with a 0.7 timetable and a support programme around it. That's been something that has been fairly well reviewed internationally, and Scottish education has been quite proud of. But as with all things, you know, there's lots of stuff that's not working in the system. So the Donaldson report, which has been a long while in its preparation, I've been in a number of professional groups that have been asked to make representation on it, has finally reported. And the main recommendations which are of interest are really around the idea of extending the programme so that the programme becomes integrated between the teacher training institutions and schools, which it doesn't at the moment, to be honest. They do their bit. They pass on a report in effect after the teachers become probationer teachers, and one side kind of mistrusts the other to a certain extent. So this is asking for tighter integration with hub schools, one of his suggestions, that you know, be like teaching hospitals in the medical kind of analogy, and that there would be much more focus on the quality of the supporters, because that's part of the deal at the moment, that there's a supporter given to each teacher, and that he's going to try and separate out the role of supporter and mentor. I'm not quite sure, you know, how he means that to be, but certainly at the moment... It's very often, you know, the subject person, if it's secondary, will be the supporter, but it may well be that the mentor would be a subject specialist or a stage specialist in primary, whereas the supporter might be someone who deals with more wide professional issues. maybe someone who's like a coach, for example, you know, someone with that kind of training.
Yeah, so it could separate out the function of coaching and assessment, maybe, or challenge. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So that's really in its headline. It's just worth saying that it's largely about a new partnership with the universities, that there would be action research projects between the universities and these hub schools, so that you know, that idea that it's them and us with teachers would be broken down a little bit, you know. And I think that's a worthy aim. That the selection and training of the teachers actually would be beefed up as well with numeracy and literacy tests. There was a separate piece of research that I almost used in the news last week, saying that a lot of people are finding that literacy and numeracy isn't strong enough in teachers, and the idea would be that it wouldn't necessarily reject you, but there would be a sort of a passing out test to see if you'd made the standard, if you'd shown any weakness in it.
So you're at your own standards, personal standards of literacy and numeracy.
Yes, as a new teacher.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some shadowing, isn't there, Sarah, in the English white paper about, because obviously going to revamp all the teacher education and talking about leading teaching schools and new partnerships with universities and so on.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what role universities end up with, because it looks like there's a much, much more of a push to schools taking on more and more of that that job, really.
Of course, you've already got that model in England, haven't you, when people can go and have school-based training?
Yes, I think there's been a bit of suspicion from governments generally about the role of academics. You know, I think they see them as confusing the waters too much, you know, putting too many critical ideas in young teachers' heads. So there's been a bit of an uneasy relationship, I think, between academia and universities and government strategy. But I don't know, there's some things in the white paper which suggest they're going to be more open to wider partnerships. I think the interesting thing is, I think Ofsted reported recently that the standards in the teacher initial training were better than the school-based ones. Getting better graduates.
Right, so that's interesting, because you know, there is a kind of a folksy belief system in the staff room, isn't there? That actually these idiots in universities don't know anything, and you know, it's a lot of nonsense. You know, but it doesn't seem that would bear that out. Then, you know, that perhaps Donaldson in Scotland has got that much right, which is that there should be tighter partnership between the two.
Yes, I think so, and I think there are sentences in the white paper which seems to suggest that might be one way to go. So. I know the new director of the Institute of Education was quite optimistic about it, I think, in a speech that he made recently. So we shall see, eh? Watch this space.
We shall indeed. What about yourself? What did you pick up on this week, Steve?
Well, it was a Michael Gove thing that just sort of came out and said, "Go compare," was the headline.
Are you going to sing it?
I've got this vision of Michael Gove popping up behind us going, that'd be a scary thought. I think I'd need some serious cardiac treatment after if that happened. But no, the department published school spending data, which is huge, huge amounts. So in theory, if you're a parent at a local school, you could go and look at your school spending and see whether it's value for money. Go compare.
Did you make the obvious pun already? Gove compare?
No. Yeah.
No, actually, I genuinely wondered if you had and I missed it. It's so obvious, sorry.
But, I mean, the trouble with all this data is that, I mean, you need to be a bit of a, you need to have a bit of nouse around you to disentangle it all. There was one head teacher in Birmingham who was complaining that her data had made it look like she was had the most expensive backroom staffing in England, you know, in her primary school. But in fact, what she had to pay for was things like the Sure Start Centre, you know, aftercare facilities, a whole range of other things that were part of her extended schools programme, you know. And also, what happens if you're in a, say, I don't know, an old 50s, 60s school which is leaking and drafty and needs the heating on all the time, and all your staff are really experienced, so they're top of the pay scale, and you've down the road you've got a brand new build which is state of the art and a whole load of new teachers. I mean, obviously, you know, you're not comparing like with like, are you?
No, absolutely not. So what's the upshot of this then?
Well, the upshot is it's part of the new increased accountability that Gove wants in the white paper. They're giving parents different kinds of information. I thought they had enough already from the previous government, but it's
going to be on the league tables, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, actually.
Which is crazy, because apparently the government are saying, well, actually, there's no correlation between spending within the school and levels of attainment. They're actually saying that categorically that there's no correlation, and yet they're putting it on the league tables and saying, go compare, as if it's the kind of information that parents should use to see if their local school is value for money. Whereas, like you say, there's so many things that are likely to have a bearing on that it's not... You know, if you think it's difficult to compare mobile phone tariffs, then, you know, this is impossible.
You can see the next public meeting, can't you, where the governor shout to the, I should like to bring it to the head teacher's attention that you have a poorer functioning toilet to pupil ratio and effective cost per plumber per capita.
Yeah.
But I'd put it to you that we actually have more square footage per classroom. You know, which doesn't leak for 3 months of the year. This could become a data nightmare.
Oh, absolutely.
And aren't they going to get rid of the... is it the contextual value-added
They
scores?
Are indeed going to get rid of the contextual value-added scores.
You know, but I can understand that they may also be fairly meaningless, but at least they are aiming at kind of doing the right thing.
I mean, those were the scores that looked at things if you had... the number of pupils for free school meals, for example, and indicators of deprivation and how much added value you put into their pupil attainment, wasn't it? And their argument is that, well, all pupils should be looked at the same, you know, but...
Yeah, I can certainly see that it's important to know whether a school is giving you value for money, but only if you have, you know, it's not like a supermarket when you can look at a number of boxes, you know, only if you have some good alternatives, you know, can we rebuild the school then to make it more cost effective, you know, more green, you know, more insulated or whatever, you know, if this data's coming out and no one in the school has the slightest ability to influence it, it seems a bit pointless. Maybe just keeping it quietly in local authority control for them to use for long-term planning.
I mean, I think there's something irritatingly... Well, not almost patronising about this government's approach to, you know, this kind of ideological thing about, well, if you've got all this data, then the market will somehow settle it. I mean, it works across this thing about local governments and health service and prison service. You know, that they say they're telling local government to cut their backroom staff. You know, there's too many chief executives being paid too much, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know. I mean, local governments seem to have been trying to cut costs for the last few years. I don't know a local authority in its right mind that says, oh, let's be really extravagant. You know, they've been paring to the bone for some time. There's this assumption that there's all this waste and bureaucracy in the system, and somehow they kind of patronise us into thinking, oh, that you know, everything will be all right if we just cut out a bit of this extravaganza.
Although I've got a thought about that, which I've been troubled by for rather a long time. One is that we probably do have a lot of waste in the system. But I think the reason for it is that so much legislation in public sector, you know, about accountability and reporting, means that you have to be, you have to be fat, you know, in terms of your provision, because it takes so much staff, you know, to
have
that
accountability.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. But when you put it in bare facts, you know, and costs per pupil, then it could look,
it
needs to be.
Probably, possibly, but I think what this government discourse is doing now is saying it's created this discourse about bureaucracy and saying that actually what's holding us back is bureaucracy, and therefore you cut it out altogether. So, in fact, you cut out a lot of all the good things that came out of local government.
Yeah, and ironically, you'll create a little bureaucratic function in feeding these league tables.
Well, yes. I mean, somebody's got to collect all this data somewhere, haven't they? So if it's not at local level, then presumably somebody in the centre's got to do it. So
it may be lighter than I fear. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway.
Can I squeeze in a little one? I know we usually only do one, but since Jay's gone, we'll be wicked and steal his spot, because I know that Sarah didn't know that we were going to do news stories. So thanks, Sarah. You brought this one entirely to my mind because you. Quite annoyed me by making me jealous over the fact that you've got some red wine there. I am terribly fond of the juice of the grape, I have to say, and I'm trying to have a night without any. But anyway, this isn't so much about red wine, but something that has a similar effect. Vaccinium cyanococcus is the theme of this story. I couldn't help but report this one to you, because not only am I an addict of the juice of the grape, but I'm something of an addict of the blueberry.
Oh, yes.
Are you guys kind of into your blueberries as well? Apparently it's become a US and a UK trend. I'm a total addict. I would say I eat them 3 or 4 times a week. It's basically all I ever have for dessert if I'm on my own. Anyway, Scientific American Mind, the January-February edition, has done a lovely little article talking about the research that started in this about 15 years ago. A couple of guys, I won't bother naming them, they did the usual cruelty to rats thing that scientists seem to get off on. And they had these poor wee rats, some of them having their ordinary scran, and some others that were getting the better scran, you know, with either bits of blueberry or strawberry or fruit, so they could compare different fruits. And what they found was that after these middle-aged rats eating this for, I think it was about 10 weeks, they were putting them through cognitive and, you know, balance and spatial tests. No doubt the rats were loving this. But it turned out the ones that were eating the blueberries were appearing in television chat shows and things. They were fairly thriving on it intellectually, and they were, you know, doing top hat and cane routines on their balance.
So it's a rat on inside learning next week, then, is it?
Yeah, well, obviously a post-blueberry rat, yeah. And of course, more recent studies have rather more humanely gone for you know, trying to identify what, you know, what the effect was, because it turned out it was the blueberries more than anything else that were making a difference then. And there's a French study, 2007, that looked at about published in 2007, looking at about 1,500 French people and tracking their learning and their diet. And what they found is a strong correlation between you know, memory and learning, and the flavonoid compounds, which are particularly strong in these blueberries, but also in general in fruits and vegetables, cereal grains, cocoa, soy foods were strongly implicated, tea and wine. So there's the wine connection.
Right. I was wondering when you were going to come back with the grapes.
So although no one's saying that you know, that this is an absolutely clear link, there's a lot of talk in the supermarkets about it being these free radicals, you know, that the antioxidant qualities of these mop that up. They don't think from this article that that's really what's going on here. It's something to do with the effect of these flavonoids, of which there are many different compounds, on actual brain chemistry itself.
There's been a whole series on these superfoods and brain chemistry, so it's an interesting area of research, which hopefully, no doubt, will develop. Did you know today was meant to be? I think is it the day that we're most likely to be depressed in the year?
Monday? Yes, it is. It absolutely is. It's Blue Monday. I've been calling it, I believe.
So more blueberries. That's our manifesto.
More
then.
Blueberries inside, for Blue Monday.
Yeah,
I must have been feeling bloody miserable myself today, so I'm going to finish celebrate the end of the podcast with a nice plate of them and some honey yogurt.
So is it significant that the rats were middle aged?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I've no idea why they use middle aged rats. I suppose it would be because maybe at that point they should equate to middle age in humans when the cognitive decline gently begins. But that's just a guess, Sarah.
Grumpier rats, then. Anyway, moving swiftly on before we stretch this rodent metaphor too far. Sarah, it's great to have you on the program tonight, and I know one of the themes that you've been working on, particularly in your work with the UFA, is the whole notion of mindsets and the sort of social psychology, particularly centered around people like Martin Seligman and Carol Dweck and so on. And you've been interested in some rather counterintuitive things have been coming up, haven't they, about praise and what we say to people. Do you just give us a very just quick introduction to the mindset?
Oh, and before that, if I could just cut across your bows, guys.
Yeah,
you guys are both intimately involved with UFA. It's a while since we've talked about it. Sarah, could you even give us a sort of 30-second pen portrait of the UFA for listeners who aren't familiar?
Okay. Well, we've been going since the mid-90s, and I suppose the idea behind the UFA is that, and it stands for the University of the First Age, is that there should be something akin to the Open University for young people. So why shouldn't young people have have exciting learning activity that's available for them in their communities and their schools, but beyond the normal school day. So a young person might be able to go and stretch themselves and do different things in different places and expand their learning beyond the school. And so, we've been working with about a third of the local authorities across England and some work in Wales. No work yet in Scotland with the UFA, so that's not good. Although we've been up there and met up with you guys and came on some of your training, the cooperative learning training, which was great. And it was
with,
great to
with
meet
my own councillor, Gail and Butte. Great on that. It was good to have you here.
So that's really what we do, is that we work with historically local authorities, more and more now clusters of schools, to set up the UFA in a local area. And so for us in the kind of central team, we spend a lot of our time developing training materials that we use with adults and with young people. We train up a lot of peer tutors and young people in other leadership roles, and also the adults that are hoping to develop the UFA in their area. So this stuff on mindset is one of the things that has kind of worked its way into the training that we do with adults and with young people. Actually, it's something that we use in our peer tutor training and in our lead learner training, and lead learners are young people who in effect lead the learning of other young people. So they either lead some of the mainstream curriculum in schools, or they lead their own learning clubs beyond the normal school day. So and mindset is one of the things that we ask them to consider when they're thinking about how to plan the learning.
So a brief introduction to mindset, and Sarah?
Okay. Well, this is based on the work of Carol Dweck, who I think started out life as a researcher looking at failure and wanted to find out how different people cope with it. And so she did lots of different kinds of experiments and with a whole range of ages. But for instance, she'd give young children a series of puzzles, and she'd give them easy puzzles to begin with and then harder puzzles, and watch them to see what kind of strategies they brought into play and how they coped with failure. And what surprised her, and what perhaps led her on a slightly different tack after that, was that actually some children responded by rubbing their hands with glee and kind of saying, come on, bring it on, I love this, this is brilliant, this is hard. And she really wasn't expecting that. And so she, through the research that she's done, the studies that she's done, has developed a theory that's now referred to as mindset, that the beliefs or the self theories, if you like, the mindsets that we hold about ourselves, whether it's generally about our intelligence or whether it's about specific abilities in different kind of subject areas perhaps, or different kind of pursuits, these beliefs can be critical for how we approach learning and how successful we are in the long term. And so throughout a massive raft of research, she's come to a theory that suggests that there are two mindsets, and they will affect the goals people pursue, the way that they respond to failure and difficulty, and how they do in school and in life. So she talks... Sorry?
No, I was just saying, and the two mindsets are...
The two mindsets are, she calls them, in her kind of more popularised work, she calls them a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. So a fixed mind, if you hold a fixed mindset, it's a theory that you hold about yourself, that but you believe your ability is fixed. It's carved.
Yeah. So I can never run faster than a limit, or I can never do maths any better than the amount I think I can do.
Yeah, or the flip side of it might also be, I am good at this, this and this. I am the best at this. I'm a natural at that. People who have got a fixed or an entity mindset, it's just that they look at what they do as giving them feedback and look for feedback that shores up this idea that they are this kind of person or that kind of person. I'm a brilliant mathematician, and so everything that I go into needs to be shoring up this view that I have of myself. Mm. And if I bump into failure or something that's a challenge or something that's difficult, then that doesn't back up that theory that I have about myself, and I don't really know how to deal with
You're
that.
Right. So it seems to me then one of the differences then you're saying between Seligman's notion of optimism and pessimism, it's not just an explanation after the event, which is what kind of optimists or pessimists do, isn't it? They explain things away after things have happened. It's actually how you orientate yourselves to choose or to do things in the first place, like a radar, isn't it?
Yeah, so people with a fixed mindset are likely to opt into things that are likely to reflect that.
Yeah. They're less likely to do things that they're already good at.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas if the growth mindset then is kind of the opposite about that, of that, it's people who hold this kind of theory of themselves believe their ability is malleable, and they quite happy then to look for challenges that are going to stretch themselves. They value learning opportunities, and actually if they bump up against failure, well, they don't quite see it as a negative thing necessarily. They see it as a learning opportunity. They look for the feedback. They look for where this is going to take them next.
So one of the things, Sarah, then, that you were telling me before the program about the feedback, one of the interesting things is the kind of praise that we give and the importance of the way we say things. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you would think that praise was a positive thing. And, you know, if you talk to anyone who's in education, perhaps, or anyone who's a parent, you know, desperately wanting to give young people positive feedback on what they're doing, and, you know, how can praise be a bad thing? And yet Dweck's work has led her to believe that actually it is possible for some very, very well-intentioned praise to be helping to nurture and grow a fixed mindset in children and young people. So if you are helping to feed this idea of ability that's carved in stone, or I am this kind of person or that kind of person, then perhaps you're helping your young person to develop a fixed mindset which will lead them to not be able to deal well with failure.
So what would be examples of sort of useful praise then for a person who's developing that mindset, or, you know, perhaps limiting praise?
Well, people with a fixed mindset see that actually effort is for losers. There's no point, you know, I'm either good at something or I'm not, and so that actually putting effort in is neither here nor there. Whereas people with a growth mindset very, very highly value effort, because that's how you get things done. You know, you put a bit more hard graft into it. So praise that will explore the relationship between the effort that somebody's put in to getting a particular result, or the particular strategies that they, or processes that they've brought to doing something, are, she suggests, things that will help that young person develop a growth mindset.
So is that praising the person for the effort and the improvement they've made, rather than just simply for saying you did that well or not?
Yeah, sure. So one of the training activities that we give to people, young people and adults alike, is we give, you know, put a load of different praise out there in speech bubbles, and we say, okay, so pick up one that you'd like to talk about and tell us whether that you think that would help to nurture a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. So, Matthew, I would say that you're a great scientist. Okay, so would that... You're agreeing with that, yeah.
The trouble is, I would just take all of those bits of praise if I had them.
But, you know, you can see how the emphasis on you and the idea that you are already this would perhaps help to nurture a fixed mindset.
Yes.
Or that you're a natural at that. Or clever boy. Mm. Whereas something that says...
Carry on.
No, don't stop right there.
If I say, I I really like the way you did that. Or can you tell me a little bit about how you got to that result? I think the way that you kept going at that and you kept persevering at that, you got that really good mark because you must have really pushed yourself, or you've really risen to the challenge. Or we're all very sensitive to the feedback we get.
Yeah.
And so to try to make sure that feedback focuses on strategies, focuses on the effort taken to get there, or engages, even if it's perhaps not praise, but engages in a dialogue about the kind of the journey as opposed to the result. So say to somebody, oh, you're brilliant at that, you're good at that, you're fantastic at that. You know, you did that without even trying, didn't you? You're a natural at that. It's perhaps not as helpful as saying, I know you really pushed yourself to do that. Well done.
Sarah, you mentioned, Sarah, the because we're running out of time rapidly here. You mentioned the training that you provide on this. Is there a link that we can put up? Where would people go for further work from yourself on this?
I could put something together that you can put on your website that is an example of one of the handouts we give, perhaps, or some slides.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
One of the places that I went to, first of all, apart from to Dweck's work herself, but Carol Craig, who is based up in Glasgow.
Yeah, I wondered if you were going to. I thought about mentioning her there just to make a Scottish link.
I'm sure that when I first started looking at this, there's a book. Is it called Creating Confidence?
I think so.
Like
she runs the Centre for Confidence.
Yeah, and I know that. And I know that, you know, this is one of the things that they look at, and certainly it's one of the places that I went. And there's some cartoon pictures that we use from there.
Okay.
So it might be worth having a link to the Centre of for Confidence. And there's a nice article. I can't remember where it's from now, but I can send it to you, or send the link to you, which is, it's from the States. It's called How Not to Talk to Your Kids.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's one that we often refer to in training as well.
Okay. So, Sarah, I've realised we've got to reunite your red wine with your meal tonight. So would you just like a quick summary, just a very quick comment on you know, the significance of this, where you think it should be in schools and education system generally?
Well, it's one, I suppose, out of all the things that we look at the UFA, we look at lots of different things that are to do with individual difference, or to do with how you set up a learning environment, or to do with the relationships and the impact that that kind of stuff has on a young person's learning and achievement. This is one of the things that I would stick right up there as almost one of the first things that, if I only had a short amount of time to talk to somebody about one thing that might really change their practice and hopefully change the experience that young people have, it would be this. I think it makes people think. I think it makes people realise that even potentially the things that we think we're doing out of the best possible intentions could even potentially have that kind of negative knock-on effect. It's absolutely one of the first things that I would want people to engage with, young people and adults alike. And young people get it. You know, you think you're doing something quite difficult, and you're wondering if the kind of concept will come across, and you know, young people on peer tutor training are like, yep, I get that. No, right. You don't want to be saying that, because that's going to help him get a fixed mindset. No, right. Actually, we've got to look at what we're saying, you know, and the key is in the language and that you use. And I think you know, it could have a big impact on the views that young people adopt for themselves, which Carol Dweck maintains could profoundly affect the way you lead your life, the things that you achieve, or whether you achieve the things that you value.
All right.
Sounds good.
Well, that sounds good. Final comment from you, Matthew?
I just really enjoyed thinking about that. Mindsets and motivation for me have always been really interesting things. Alan McLean in Scotland has taken a lot of Dweck's work and put it into a model that he's added to and extended and packaged in his own way. I would also refer listeners to some interesting work, which wasn't just on the how the feedback, Sarah, tells you about, you know, whether it's been about your effort or just whether you've naturally got it or you haven't. But a cracking wee piece on the kind of nature of the reward as well that you get in Predictably Irrational by Dan O'Reilly, an author I really enjoy. He talked an awful lot about how as the stakes get larger or smaller, people respond differently as well, perhaps depending on the type that they are. That's got resonances, of course, for the current controversy about whether bankers should be paid big bonuses. Yes. Because he discovered in his research that the larger the rewards were, the more people gave in easily. Which is interesting. But yeah. I'm not saying that's like, so it's just you made me think about that as well. You know, there's so much about, you know, not just feedback, but feedback and reward.
But
really interesting, and I would certainly urge listeners to go and get stuck into that. And
Probably the best thing to read is it's just called Mindset.
Yeah,
that's the more popular of her books, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very, you know, really easy to read, but and goes into the detail about the, you know, some of the experiments that she's done, which are fascinating in themselves.
Yeah. So, Sarah, that's been a brilliant introduction, and we obviously raised some issues that we can follow up in further programs. So I do hope you're going to join us again.
Yeah, sure I will.
You must. It's been great to have you on board again. It's like the old days again. Fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I enjoyed this evening's episode, so thank you very much, folks, and we wish you a good night.
That's been great. Thanks, Steve, for steering us in at a good 35 minutes.
Well, those blueberries did go on a bit.
That's Jay's fault. He wasn't here to moderate things.
Well, it's great to have taken part tonight, so thanks, both of you.
Okay, good night, then.
Good night.
Good night.